Let's go on now to special senses. Now, senses in general, you were probably lied to somewhere along your life. You probably were taught that there are five senses, five human senses. There are many more than that, actually, so that was, you were lied to. There are two major categories of senses, which are general senses, as one category, and special senses. What makes a general sense general is that it is not localized, spread out over the entire surface of the body, basically, more or less. And it all, a general sense also does not have a very complex or elaborate sense organ. Now, we talked about these sensory receptors already, the ones that are located in the skin, somewhere in the dermis, things like Pacinian corpuscles and Golgi tendon organs and things like that. Those are all organs for general senses, and they're general senses because you don't have a touch organ that you have, you know, it's the only place you could feel being touched, right? They're not localized. They're spread out over the body. That's why they're general senses. And there's many general senses, actually. There's a sense of vibration, a sense of temperature, a sense of itch. So those are all general senses. And so, when you were told there were five senses, really, it wasn't a total lie, because there are five special senses, and then many more general senses. But it was still a lie because you were probably told, I'm assuming, but it's probable, that you were told that one of those five special senses is the sense of touch. That's not a special sense. I just told you that's a general sense, right? You don't have a touch organ that you have to specifically touch in order to feel something. It's all over your body. So that means that since touch, which can also be called traction, tactile means having to do with touch. That's a general sense. Since it's not a special sense, what are the five? Well, you should certainly know four of them, because that part was correct when you were taught that. What are the four special senses that you learned? Taste, another name for that, anyone know? It is gustation. Gustatory is the adjective, meaning having to do with food or tasting. Okay? These are all going to be special senses, not general. What else? Sight or vision? Olfaction is the sense. Olfaction is the adjective. Or smell. Might have learned it as smell as well.
Hearing
or audition. Auditory is the adjective. And then what's the fifth? It's not touch. That's, like I said, general. Well, think of these four. First of all, these all qualify as special senses because special senses are highly localized, basically in the head. Not just all over the body. There's a localized place, and there's a highly complex, specialized organ for that sense. So you have taste buds for gustation, only in the head. You have vision. I mean, you have eyeballs for vision. You have nose for olfaction. And you have ears for audition. Those are special sense organs. Well, ears actually are dual organs. So one of the special senses the ear is responsible for, part of the ear, is audition. It's also responsible for the fifth special sense, which is balance. Okay, so those are the true five special senses. And let's, we're not going to look at with equal detail at all five of these, so we don't really have time, but this chapter focuses on a couple of them, starting with vision, which is appropriate because you're doing your eye dissection today. So in the opening slide, we obviously are looking at an eye. Now, eye really refers to not just the eyeball, but associated structures that are outside of the eyeball. Things that you're probably familiar with, like eyebrows and eyelashes. Eyelashes, by the way, can also be called cilia, which is a word that just simply means hair. The eyelashes come out of structures that you probably know as eyelids, which is okay to call them. It's what this book calls them, but they are also called palpebrae. The singular is palpebra, but two of them or more are palpebrae. So cilia are the hairs. They grow out of the eyelids, which are the palpebrae. Oh, okay. Why do you have eyelashes? To keep major specks of dirt and stuff from entering your eye as much as possible, yes. The eyebrows, why do you have those? Yes, sweat. It's not perfect, of course. If you sweat enough, it's going to drip into your eye anyway. But mild sweating will be stopped by the eyebrows and kind of routes it around your eye. That's one thing. But also, eyebrows are really important signaling devices, right? We talked about how much brain power is devoted to facial expression. Well, a lot of that involves eyebrows. Okay. The eyelids, of course, there's a top and a bottom one, or superior and inferior one. They come together at the edges, though, and those edges have special names. You can call them either commissures. Now, that's the same word that we used when we described some of the neural fibers, right? Commissures cross over from right to left in the brain or in the central nervous system. Well, that's why they're called commissures here. You're crossing over from the upper lid to the lower lid. Or they can be called acanthus. And so there's a lateral canthus. Laterals, you already know what that means. And a medial canthus. The eyeball itself, most people focus on the thing that gives it its color, what we call the eye color, which is the iris. Now, the iris can change shape because it's muscular. It's a ring of muscle, but it's also pigmented. That's why it has whatever color it has. And since it's muscle, it can change the diameter of the hole inside it. So we call that hole the pupil. The pupil's not really a structure. It's just a hole in the iris. But the iris, by changing the amount of contraction that it's undergoing, can adjust the diameter of the pupil. Why do we do that?
Taking less light or taking more light?
Right. We adjust the amount of light that's able to come through as appropriate, depending on how much light there is. Sometimes it's too much light, sometimes it's not enough, and so the iris adjusts. Which is why if you go into a dark bathroom, for instance, and you can tell you're looking in the mirror, but it's not, you haven't turned the light on yet. If you turn the light on, you'll see your pupils get small immediately, because that extra light is the stimulus that tells the iris to constrict the pupil. Now, the iris seems like it's in the front of the eye, but it's not actually in the front. We're looking through something to actually see the iris. It's not on the surface. And the very front of the eye is the cornea, which is amazingly transparent, at least in youth. I say amazingly transparent because this is living stuff. It's made of cells. And something that's made of cells being that transparent is pretty impressive. Of course, it needs to be transparent because otherwise we would see it, right? So it is a nice clear window right in the front. The cornea is continuous with, though. The cornea is like a layer, That layer is continuous with what we call the white of the eye, but that's more properly called the sclera. Now, what is the meaning of sclera? It's used in a lot of different words. Like scleroderma, for instance, is a disorder that means tough skin. The skin gets real thick and leathery. That's what sclera means, tough. And you should gain an appreciation of this today when you dissect the eyeball, because it's, if you've never done it before, it's surprising how much force is required to actually puncture an eyeball. It's because that sclera is really tough stuff. Very fibrous tissue. Now, it's tougher than the cornea because the cornea can't be as tough since it has to be transparent. But the cornea itself is impressively tough. And it's all the same layer. It's just that the front of it gets clear. That's what we call the cornea. Okay. Let's go on to slide 2. This is a sagittal section, but not a median section, right? If it were a median section, it wouldn't go through either eyeball. It's a sagittal section through one of the eyeballs. And we're really not caring about the detail of the eyeball itself here, but we're looking at a cross-section through the middle of the lids. And to the lateral side of each eye, as we'll see in a different view, is what's called a lacrimal gland. Lacrimal, referring to lacrimation. What is lacrimation? Crying. Right. Now, we use the word crying emotionally, right? It's excessive tear formation because of some emotional reason. But you're always producing tears continuously. The lacrimal gland is just low-level output continuously. If you have an emotional response, it can be drastically increased. Or if you get hit in the face with a basketball, it's also going to cause you to cry. Not because of the pain, just because of the trauma. But usually it's just a very tiny drip from the lacrimal gland. And that those tears wash over the surface of the eye. We'll see a better view of that in the next slide. But look at this pink layer. I just told you that the cornea is right in the front. Technically, that's not actually even true. This section of blue right here is the cornea. But directly on the cornea, for instance, if you touch your eyeball, or if you put on a contact lens, you're not directly touching the cornea. What you directly contact is a thin layer of cells, one cell layer thick, basically, called the conjunctiva, which can become inflamed, and that's what we call conjunctivitis. Itis simply means inflammation. But that's this thin layer that's directly on the surface of the cornea. Notice, though, that it wraps around and also covers the inner surface of each eyelid or palpebra. And then the space between those two layers is where the tears get delivered. And that's why blinking will swish those tears around the surface of the eye, washing it. That's what we see in slide 3, denoted by the black arrows. So this is just under normal situations. You're not aware of the lacrimal gland continuously cleaning your eyes, but it is. It's not just about cleaning them, also. Tears contain antimicrobial agents, so they can kill bacteria, which is important because any moist opening to your body is a site for potential infection. Your skin is dry and protective of things that could invade you unless you cut the skin. But you have moist openings in your body, and that's where you can easily be infected, which is why, you know, when you catch cold or something, it's usually through your nose or your eyes. So the tears are trying to battle that as much as they can by killing those bacteria. But it swishes across the surface, and then eventually drain the tears, that is, drain at a couple little drain spots at the medial canthus. And so the rest of this stuff is drawn as though it's on the surface, but it's deep. You don't actually see it, of course. It's just the pipes that come from those drains. And they drain into a bigger pipe called the lacrimal sac, one on either side. And then it eventually will dump into the nasal cavity. So when this is happening just on a normal moment-to-moment basis, it's so low flow that your nose isn't running. It just becomes part of the moisture in your nasal cavity. As you breathe, that gets evaporated. But if it's overwhelmed, like whether it's emotional crying or something hits you in the eye, the lacrimal gland is going to ramp up tear production so much that it's too much for the drains to handle, so it spills over the front. There's still a lot going down the drains, though, and that's why your nose will start running as well. All right, let's go to four. You can see the eyeball here, but the soft tissue other than these muscles has been removed just so that you can see it in the bony eye socket. Now, what do we call the eye sockets? They're named after the eyeballs, really. What's another name for a sphere? Which the eyes pretty much are. Orb. So the eyes are orbs, and therefore the eye sockets, the bony sockets, are called orbits. So this is an eyeball in an orbit. And with all the other soft tissue that's nearby removed, we can see that there are several muscles attached directly to the eyeball. Now, the muscles are attached to the eyeball, but they're not actually part of the eyeball. So we call them collectively extrinsic eye muscles. Extrinsic simply means occurring outside of, rather than intrinsic, which is inside. There are intrinsic eye muscles as well, including the muscles of the iris I was talking about that adjust the pupil. That's inside the eyeball. These are outside. So the extrinsic eye muscles are about moving the eyeball in different directions, which not all animals can do, by the way. If you look at a bird, it doesn't move its eyes like we do. It's evolved to have such big eyes so that it can maximize its vision that there's really no room for muscles. So it just moves its head. It keeps its eyeballs in pointing in the same direction. We move our eyeballs, though, obviously. And we do that with six extrinsic eye muscles per eyeball. So each one of the right and the left, each has six. Now, four of those six extrinsic eye muscles are rectus muscles. Remember that word from when you had to learn it before? What does rectus mean? Straight, exactly. And so there's four rectus muscles because they are straight along the four corners, in a sense, of the circle. One directly at the top, one directly at the bottom, and one on either side. So, besides just calling them all rectus, which we wouldn't be able to do because we wouldn't be able to tell which one we're talking about, there's those directional words in the name, which should be self-explanatory at this point. So there's an inferior rectus on the bottom, a superior rectus on the top, a medial rectus toward the nose, and a lateral rectus toward the side. So that's four of the six. The other two are oblique muscles. And what does that mean in general? Yeah, at some other angle, some diagonal, unspecified angle. And so there's two of these, a superior oblique muscle and an inferior oblique muscle. And they are able to move the eyeball diagonally. And they're also, to a certain extent, able to twist it a little bit in the socket. That doesn't happen very much. But that's the six extrinsic eye muscles. And just keep in mind that any muscle can only contract, right? It can only pull. So the lateral rectus, if it pulls, since it's connected to the lateral side of the eyeball, that means your eye is going to move laterally. And similarly for the others. Okay, now a cartoon version of the eyeball itself, slide 5. When I mentioned the cornea first, we were looking directly at the front of it, and you can't tell from that direction, so I didn't mention it at the time, but the cornea is a bulge forward. If it weren't for this bulge, the eyeball would be pretty spherical. If the sclera just continued on the front, of course that would block the light, but it would be a pretty good sphere. Nice and circular. The cornea, though, you can see here, is the same layer as the sclera. It's just that it becomes not quite as tough so that it can be transparent, and it bulges outward. Now, you might not have realized this because everyone's familiar with the fact that the lens focuses light rays. We haven't talked about the lens yet. But actually, most of the focusing, most of the bending of light rays, which is called refraction, occurs at the cornea. At least in us animals who are terrestrial, that live in air rather than in water. For fish, this is not true. And the reason for that is because when light is traveling through some medium, whatever medium is just whatever it's traveling through, and then it encounters a different medium with different density, either greater or lesser density, then it will bend or refract. Well, for us terrestrial or land-dwelling organisms, the medium around us is air, not water. And air is a hell of a lot less dense than water. So when light is traveling through air first and then it strikes the cornea, which is about the density of water, because that's what it mostly is, that's a drastic change in density, so it refracts a lot. And that's why the cornea does most of the focusing. But it's not adjustable, so it bends it a lot. You know, though, that you have to make it just right for it to look in focus to you, right? And that depends on how far away the object is that you're looking at. That's why you have the lens to do the fine focusing for whatever particular object you're looking at, and that's what gets it focused for you, for sharp vision. It's not as much bending that occurs there, though, because now it's already in a watery environment, and the lens is itself pretty watery, so it's not a very drastic change in density. That's why. For fish, by the way, the light is already in water before it hits the eye, so that's not very drastic either. Their corneas don't bend it very much, which means their lenses have to really take care of most of the focusing. And their lenses work differently from ours. Ours change their thickness. A fish's works just like a camera. The lens is moved forward or backward, just like when you rotate the barrel of a lens on a camera. That's what it's doing. Okay, well anyway, back to us, not fish. There are three major layers in the eyeball. Before we get to that, let me say that there's also two major spaces in the eyeball, or chambers. If it weren't for a wall, there would be only one big chamber inside. But the wall is made up by the lens and the iris and a ring of muscle around the lens. All of this stuff right here is like a wall between this front chamber and this back chamber. But of course, we don't say front and back in anatomy, so this is called the anterior chamber. And this is called the posterior chamber. So the anterior chamber is between the inside of the cornea and the front of the lens. The posterior chamber is between the back of the lens and the back of the eyeball. Well, both of these chambers are filled with fluid, but it's drastically different fluid in consistency. The anterior chamber is filled with a very watery substance, and that's why that stuff is called aqueous humor, meaning watery. Whereas the posterior chamber, which is by far bigger, it's most of the inside of the eyeball, is filled with vitreous humor. You probably learned that from the video you watched in preparation for today. Any idea what vitreous means? Same root as in vitro. Have you heard in vitro fertilization, for instance, or some other in vitro technique? What does that actually mean? When something is done in vitro, what are they doing? What did they call the first in vitro fertilization babies? Well, you might not be old enough to remember. Test tube babies, yeah. Vitro means glass. So when you talk about an in vitro technique, they're talking about using laboratory glassware. And so vitreous means glassy. Now, it's not glassy in the sense that it's solid like glass. It just has a glassy, shiny appearance, but it's really gelatinous. It's also impressively transparent. So you can see it swish around, but there's not any color to it. Except for today, by the way. The cornea is not transparent today when you're in dissection. Neither is the lens, neither is the vitreous, because it's all been clouded by the preservative. But if you were to use, you know, a fresh eye, freshly taken out of an organism, this stuff would be impressively clear, including the lens. The lens is pretty tough stuff, and it's made of living cells, but it's so transparent that if you take it out of a fresh eye and plop it into a little glass of water, you won't see it at all. It'll just look like it's part of the water. Now, that's important, of course, because it has to be clear. It eventually doesn't stay that clear in age. You know, you get cataracts and fogging of the lens, but early on, it's pretty clear. All right, so we have vitreous humor in the posterior chamber, aqueous humor in the anterior chamber, and then the lens and associated materials forming the boundary between those two chambers. Now let's talk about... Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I have some question. So when, like, you get a cataract...
I don't. when one does?
Yes. Do they, like, because I've seen a video before where they, like, cut open the lens, and then is it like a, because does the lens, like, inside of it become cloudy, or is there something that, because it looks like something's covering it.
There is a covering. Now, I'm not going to say that the inside of the lens can't become cloudy as well. It's just it is mostly surface.
Oh, okay. So it's like peeling away.
Yeah, but I don't know specifically what they do clinically. They also, though, replace lenses, right? They sometimes take the lens all the way out and put one in that is not adjustable like a living lens is. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a fixed focus lens, and therefore they need usually glasses in addition to that to make up for it. The three layers that I was talking about on the eyeball, you can describe as superficial, intermediate, and deep, right? But superficial means toward the outside of the eyeball, as you would expect for superficial. Deep means toward the interior. So we've already talked about the superficial layer. That's the sclera and the cornea combined. That's the so-called fibrous layer because it's such tough stuff. The innermost layer, which would be the deepest layer, that's the layer that's in direct contact with the vitreous humor, is the retina, which in here is this yellowish layer. The retina is the sensitive, the light-sensitive layer. And it has neural cells making it up. Light sensitive cells, which in general are called photoreceptors. Photoreceptors are part of the cells that make up the retina. And there are two general categories of photoreceptors. You might know these. What are the two categories of photoreceptors that humans have? Rods and cones. Because of their different shapes. One of them is more cylindrical and the other one taper, so it's those are cones. Now, the difference between these two is that rods are much easier to cause to fire. By fire, I mean create an action potential. So it doesn't take nearly as much light to activate a rod. And they are important, therefore, in very dim lighting situations. But because they're so sensitive, they aren't able to give information about color. So it's basically just shades of gray that it tells the brain about. Cones, on the other hand, come in three varieties. There are red-sensitive ones, green-sensitive ones, and blue-sensitive ones. And depending on which ones are firing and what combinations, that gives information to the brain about color, as well as whether what the object is shaped like. It requires enough light, though, for that to happen. And so I don't know whether you've ever thought about doing this or have experienced it, but if you're driving in the middle of nowhere, you have to be way out from the city, middle of nowhere where there aren't lights. The only lights are your headlights. Those headlights are nice and bright, so you'll see colors in front of you. But if you look off to the side, whatever it is, a field or whatever, you'll see shapes, but you won't really see, it looks like it's black and white. That's because that dim light is only causing your rods to fire, whereas the headlight is causing your cones to fire, and you have color information. Well, all of those, the three kinds of cones plus the rods, are all part of the retina, along with some other cells that we'll look at in a minute. But that's the deepest layer, the innermost layer. And a really important function of the vitreous humor is to properly press that retina against the back wall of the, you know, it's kind of like wallpaper. It needs to be spread nicely against the back of the eyeball because, well, we used to say that the eyes are like cameras and the retina is like the film, but you have to explain nowadays what film is to people. They're all digital cameras. In a digital camera, the light-sensitive part is the CCD. Anyway, that's what the retina is really like nowadays, but if you want to still compare them to cameras. And that has to be at the right distance from the lens in order for the lens to focus it well. Like if there were a pull-down screen for this projector, it would be focused only if it's the right distance from the projector. If I were to grab it and move it forward, things would go out of focus, right? Same with the retina. It can't just float out into the posterior chamber. It needs to be nicely pressed against the back wall, but not too hard. If the pressure gets too hard, that's going to damage the retina. That's what glaucoma is all about. But the vitreous humor, under normal circumstances, provides just enough pressure to nicely put it against the back wall. So those are two layers. In between those two layers, shown here in pink, is the choroid. Now, this is the same exact word that we used for choroid plexus, and it means the same thing. Like the chorion, which is part of the placenta, nothing to do at all with the eye. It just looks, in appearance, like the choroid tissue does when you dissect it. That's why someone named it that. But in terms of what it is, it's a collection of blood vessels. It's important to get blood to all the parts of the eye, just like it is to get blood to any other living part. So there's a rich blood supply in the choroid, but it doesn't go as close to most cells as it does in the rest of the body. For instance, you don't have blood vessels running through the cornea, even though the cornea is made of living cells, or the lens, because you would see those, right? You can't have blood there. And that's why things have to diffuse through the vitreous humor or through the aqueous humor to get to those cells. That's what allows them to remain clear. Okay, now let's go to 6 and look at the retina in greater detail. So this is just the retina we're looking at. The lower right, where you see the light coming toward it, that's toward the interior of the eyeball. So this is vitreous humor right here in the posterior chamber. So this is the innermost layer, the deepest layer. But the deepest layer is what the light strikes, right? It doesn't strike the choroid or the sclera. It's coming from inside. So the choroid would be here. The sclera would be outside of that. And this is the back of the eyeball, just like you see right here. Light has to strike rods or cones in order for it to be sensed. Because the rods and the cones, after a light strikes them, they create an action potential that's sent through neurons to the brain. Unless that happens, the brain won't create an image for you, won't create the sensation of vision. So that has to happen. Well, what is kind of surprising is that light first has to go through a couple layers of cells before it even has a chance of hitting rods or cones. The rods and cones are back here. These are the rods and cones. You see the labels. And so information is going to flow from the rods and cones in the form of action potentials. But notice that it's traveling this direction, toward the front of the retina, into two different kinds of cells that are end-to-end hooked to the rods and cones. You have bipolar cells hooked to the rods and cones, and then hooked to the bipolar cells are ganglion cells that have long axons that eventually leave the eyeball and move toward the brain. Okay, so the light has to make it through this mess of bipolar and ganglion cells before it even has a chance of striking a rod or a cone. Now, if you were designing the body, you'd want it to be the reverse, right? You'd want to have the rods and cones up here in front where the light strikes. And that would, this stuff is in the way, really. But light, you know, some light actually does strike these cells and it just gets absorbed and therefore we don't sense it. We aren't as efficient at collecting light because of this arrangement. If you had the rods and cones up here, though, it would work a lot better. Anyway, it's just interesting that that's how we evolve. But the information, assuming the information starts because light hits a rod or a cone, that information is in the form of action potentials, which then travel from cell to cell and eventually leave the eyeball through the optic nerve, one of the cranial nerves. And you'll see the optic nerve on the back of the eyeball, the stub of it. It's been cut, of course. All right, before I leave this, notice this pigmented layer of the retina. In us, we have cells making up the pigmented layer. A pigment is something that absorbs light of certain wavelength. And so that's why pigments look colored to us, because some of the light gets absorbed and the rest gets reflected, and whatever gets reflected is what we sense. But the pigmented layer in our eyeballs absorbs pretty much all the visible light, doesn't reflect any. And the reason for that is that if light comes in and it doesn't hit a rod or a cone, which happens all the time, then the pigmented layer will absorb that light so it doesn't bounce off in another direction and confuse us. But when you do your dissection today, you're doing it not with a human eye, but with a cow eye, which is an example of an animal that instead of having a pigmented layer like we do, has a special pigmented layer called the tapetum lucidum. And that, instead of absorbing the light, actually intentionally reflects it. You see this a lot, especially in mammals that have nocturnal activity. They're active at night when there obviously isn't nearly as much light. If it's moonlight or whatever, not nearly as much light. So if the light, the very little light that they have, makes it all the way through this and does not hit a rod or a cone and would therefore otherwise be wasted, the tapetum lucidum will bounce it back directly in the same direction and give it a second chance of hitting a rod or a cone so that it is much more efficient at using the light that's available. But that's why animals with tapetum lucidum have really shiny eyes when you shine lights on them at night. Okay, 7. Notice where we are in the eyeball here. This yellow is the retina, but we're right at the part of the back of the eye where all of the axons from all these sensitive cells come together to form a bundle that's going to leave the eye as the optic nerve. That has to happen at one space. So the axons start out as those ganglion cells spaced all around the retina. And then they're fibers that are coming together to form a big bundle all in one place. And that one place where they all come together, there isn't any room there for light to make it through to hit rods or cones. There aren't any rods or cones there. It's just because the axons are taking up the room, so no rods or cones here. And therefore that, called the optic disc, is what corresponds to what we say is the blind spot of the eye. So light is falling on this, but the brain has no idea that light is falling on it because there are no photoreceptors there, right? And that means everything you look at really has a black hole in it as far as your brain is concerned, because it's not getting any light wherever, you know, if you keep your eyes still on a scene, somewhere in that scene there's really a black hole there. And you can do something called the blind spot test, which is pretty cool, but where you have an X on the paper, and if you put it in the right position, if it's on a white paper, it will just totally disappear and it will look like a blank page, because you're forcing that light from the X to fall on the blind spot, which the brain doesn't know about. But what's amazing about that is that you don't see a black hole in the paper. You see it as a white paper. And that's because the brain says, well, it's white all the way around, so I'm just going to assume that it's white there, and I'm going to fill it in, make it feel like you're seeing white there, even though you're not really seeing it. That's amazing in itself, but you can do the same thing. You know, if you look at this flag that's on the wall, there's a blind spot there too, and you could put an X on the flag and make the X disappear, but the brain wouldn't fill it in with white. It says, oh, it's red and white stripes, so I'm just going to put red and white stripes in there. And it does it perfectly so that you can't even tell that you don't see these holes that are there all the time. Anyway, that's called the blind spot. And that's really the only important thing about that slide. If we go on to 8, we can talk about light in a little bit more detail. For one thing, light is a type of energy called electromagnetic energy. Electromagnetic energy is so called because there's an electrical component to it and a magnetic component to it. I'm not going to get too deep into the physics of electromagnetic radiation, which is what light is, but it occurs in waves. And anything that occurs in waves, you can measure a wavelength for. A wavelength, as the word length indicates, is just a distance. It's a distance from one part of the wave to the next part of the wave that's just like that part. So you can measure it anywhere as long as you go to the next corresponding place. It's always going to be the same distance. That's the wave. That's one wavelength. Well, there are waves that have long wavelengths and waves that have short wavelengths. And so there is a spectrum of electromagnetic energy going from very short wavelength to very long wavelength. It's all the same stuff. It's all electromagnetic radiation. But only a tiny fraction of that whole spectrum happens to be the right wavelengths for it to interact with our rods and cones. And so that's the only light that we can see. That's what we usually mean when we say light. Meaning the humanly visible portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. But the rest of the stuff is exactly the same stuff, we just can't see it. And that includes things like radio waves, That's long wavelength light that's always going through our bodies, but we have no way of detecting it. Microwaves, same thing. Ultraviolet radiation that from sunlight that damages your skin, that's also electromagnetic. And the shorter the wavelengths beyond the visible range, the more dangerous it gets. So UV, by the way, it's called ultraviolet because the humanly visible portion is a span of wavelengths, and wavelengths determine the color to us. It's a span of wavelengths from red to violet. You've probably learned Roy G. Biv before, right? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Those were the colors of the rainbow. Well, violet is at the edge. That's the shortest wavelengths that we can see. And therefore, when you get even shorter wavelengths, it's still light, but it's called ultraviolet because it's above violet in the scale. And if you get invisible at the other end, because it's too long beyond red, we call it infrared, below red. Okay, so within that range, which is, this is not exact, but it's roughly 400 to 700 nanometers in wavelength. A nanometer is a tiny, tiny fraction of a meter. But anyway, 400 roughly to 700 is the humanly visible spectrum. Now, other animals can see beyond this range. For instance, insects can see ultraviolet light. It has a color to them, but we can't imagine it just because we can't sense it. Anyway, within our range, we have different cones that are good at absorbing different ranges within the visible range. That's what these three curves on the graph indicate. So there are blue sensitive cones that, now each cone can sense a big fraction of the spectrum. It's not just a single color, but the so-called blue cones do really well at blue and not as well toward green. And then you have green cones that are specialized in at the green. It peaks out at green, and then red ones as well toward the red end. And so anything that looks any color other than red, green, or blue is just causing multiple kinds of cones to fire. It's the particular mixture. But red, green, and blue are the three primary colors for this reason. And that's why, you know, if you adjust color on a computer screen, it will give you a red, green, blue slider or some way of adjusting it. You can make any color out of just combining red, green, and blue in different ratios. And if you have all three of them, that's white. White light contains all of the wavelengths. And if all of those wavelengths get bounced back to our eye, we'll see that as a white thing. Now, we say things have color. They really don't. Like we say, a plant is green. The plant is not green. Greenness is a sensation in our brain. But things that we say are green look green to us, because the other colors get absorbed. Now, plants are photosynthetic, and so they need the energy from the light in order to make their food. That's what photosynthesis is. They can't do that unless they absorb that energy. So that's why they have pigments. Pigments absorb light. But chlorophyll, which is the pigment that makes photosynthesis work in plants and also makes them look green to us, it's a pigment that does not absorb green light. And therefore, if you give a plant nothing but green light, it's going to die. It's going to starve because it can't absorb green light. Chlorophyll absorbs blue and red very well. And so that's what gives the energy to the plant. Sunlight comes in as white, combination of all the colors. The red and the blue get absorbed, and they therefore don't get bounced back to our eyes. The green does. And that's why the brain eventually makes it look green to us, because only those wavelengths corresponding to green get bounced back. Yeah.
So, like, I don't know if this connects to it, but when people, like, develop photos or film,
yeah,
and they're, like, under, like, red lights, like, why do they do that?
Because the red light is right at the edge of the sensitivity of the silver particles that in film photography, in silver image photography, as it's called, has to be above the level of red for it to actually cause the reaction that makes them black, because it's actually negatives, right? Mm-hmm. What is white in the scene becomes black in the negative, and that's because the light causes the silver to become black, but red light doesn't do that.
Oh.
Not really far red doesn't. Some red does, but not the far red. And that's what you see in dark rooms, that far red light. Mm-hmm. That way you can see what the hell you're doing in there without actually ruining the film or the paper or the negatives. Oh. But if you're doing it color, it has to be totally black, because red light would ruin color photography, film photography. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's just go ahead and stop there, because that's about how far I got in my other section. I want to keep them even. And that gives you an extra 6 minutes to study for today's quiz.